The Legal Corner Podcast Series. Welcome to today's episode of The Legal Corner, a podcast which covers a variety of legal issues to keep you informed. Hosted by attorney at law Colin Dinoon and communication specialist Leonardo Torres.
Thank you for tuning in for another episode of the Legal Corner podcast series. I am your host, Colin Dinoon, attorney at law, and my co-host, Leonardo Torres, is absent today because of work commitments. In today's episode, we'll be looking at improving industrial relations. In recent times, there has been a lot of coverage in the local media surrounding industrial relations issues in Trinidad and Tobago, ranging from the government's 4% final offer to public servants to the industrial court granting an injunction to restrain teachers from engaging in days of rest and reflection. This begs the question, is there anything that can be done to improve the present industrial relations climate? Well, in today's episode, joining me on the podcast to present some perspective on this is Mr. Anderson Superly, attorney at law. Just to give you a bit of information about him, he's currently employed as a senior legal counsel with the Securities and Exchange Commission, better known as TTSEC. And by means of his educational pursuits, he would have achieved a LLB at the University of London, LEC, U Wooding, 2006, Master of LIS, Library Information Systems, in Canada, 2008, and he has also done pro bono legal work with the All Trinidad General Workers Union, 2014 to 2017. He has been a part-time lecturer at Cipriani Labor College for over 10 years in legal issues and human resource management. Mr. Superly has also been a part-time lecturer at the University of the West Indies Open Campus in Industrial Relations Management. And on top of all of that, he's also a trade union activist and shop steward with Big Woo, the banking, insurance, and general workers union. Good day to you, Anderson, and welcome to Legal Corner.
Thank you, Colin. I am humbled by the invitation, and I look forward to our chat this afternoon.
Excellent. So I want us to get started. Tell us a bit about the industrial court. What would you say is the role of the industrial court?
Okay. The industrial court was established by Act of Parliament in 1971, the Industrial Relations Act. The Act establishes court to deal specifically with issues and circumstances relating to the industrial relations climate in Trinidad and Tobago at the time. And it has continued to do to basically cater for industrial relations issues throughout its existence. It's essentially there to resolve disputes among workers and employers. Strange, however, in Trinidad and Tobago, it is estimated that just about 20 to 25% of the working population are members of trade unions. And this is important because it is only the employer and the trade union that has locus standi or has the ability to present matters before the court. The employer, on its own behalf, through its legal representatives or consultants, as the case might be, and the trade unions on behalf of the workers. To clarify, a worker in his individual capacity cannot bring a matter to the industrial court. It must be effectively through a trade union.
Very interesting. Thank you for clarifying that. What was the reason behind the government of the day deciding to bring about the industrial court? What led to its genesis?
Okay. Prior to the Industrial Relations Act, Trinidad and Tobago was faced with a lot of industrial relation activities, strikes, lockouts, protests, and so on. Remember, if we recall from our history, 1970 was a period of upheaval in the country, right? And just prior to 1970, there would have been serious industrial relations unrest in the country. And there was something called the Industrial Stabilization Act prior to 1971. It was a draconian piece of legislation skewed towards, I wouldn't want to use the word, but I may as well use it, the word to more be a method of keeping workers in check. The Industrial Relations Act basically repealed the Industrial Stabilization Act and established for the first time and in very few countries what we have today as an industrial court, a specialized court to deal with industrial relations issues. Yeah, and that is the reason that the court was established, to deal with industrial relations issues, not merely labor issues, but industrial relations issues. And as we go along in talk, you would realize that industrial relations issues are broad in the sense that they cover things like retrenchment, severance, other benefits, minimum wages, maternity protection, things like sexual harassment in the workplace. All these are things that are litigated or brought before the court for some sort of redress by affected persons.
Right. Excellent. And how are the judges on the industrial court appointed?
Okay. So if my statement just now indicated that the role of the industrial relations court or industrial court is wide-ranging: maternity protection, sexual harassment, minimum wages, things like that. So the first thing we must discover about the industrial court is that the judges themselves are not necessarily only lawyers. They come from a wide area of backgrounds: industrial relations, economic backgrounds, management backgrounds, and so on. And that is because of the nature of the court and purpose of the court to deal with industrial relations matters. So the only judge that is really appointed in the normal sense, like Supreme Court judges through the Judicial and Legal Service Commission, is the president of the court. The president of the industrial court is appointed by the Judicial and Legal Services Commission. All the other judges are appointed by the president on the advice of the cabinet. And that advice comes about after consultations with stakeholders of the court. This would include labor, employers, and of course the president of the court, who is an appointed judge as prescribed under the Constitution. Yeah.
Right. Now, are there any differences between the industrial court and the high court?
Okay. First, let me tell you that there's a similarity between both courts. They are both known as superior courts of record. That is to say, they have what is called inherent or unlimited jurisdiction. And their judgments are recorded and subject to the process of appeal, unlike, let's say, administrative tribunals or courts that are not courts of records, right? But there is a significant difference between the industrial court and the high court, notwithstanding that both are superior courts of record that have unlimited jurisdiction. Just like the high court, the industrial court can issue injunctions, right? Hold people for con- in contempt of court and so on. But the industrial court is a specialized court. It deals only with industrial relations. And once you are a worker, as defined under the Industrial Relations Act, by law, you cannot bring a matter before the High Court. You must go to the Industrial Court with any matter. And when you go to the Industrial Court as a worker, now there's a specific definition of a worker under the Industrial Relations Act. And because you are defined as a worker, your route for addressing issues that you may have with an employer is through the Industrial Court and not directly to the High Court. If you are not a worker as defined under the Industrial Relations Act, your manner or method of redress is through the High Court. Now, you might ask, well, and isn't every employer a worker? No, under our industrial relations system, not every employee is a worker. Some persons may be classified as managerial staff, in which case they can only have redress through the High Court. It is only workers as defined under the Industrial Relations Act that can actually seek redress through the Industrial Court. You might ask as well, what about teachers and public officers and so on? Well, they have their own method of redressing issues. And that is through what we call a special tribunal. That's the initial stage of bringing a matter to court, so to speak. Interestingly, the Industrial Court, through its Essential Services Division, sits as a special tribunal with members from the other division of the Industrial Court. So these teachers, the police, the fire services, and so on, their disciplinary matters or matters with their employer are usually or will be sent to special tribunal, which is basically an extension of one of the essential services division of the Industrial Court. And if I am to clarify, there are actually two divisions to the court. The General Services Division and the Essential Services Division. The General Services Division, workers of a general class can take matters through their union, through the General Services Division. The Essential Services Division would basically have workers from places like TSTT or WASA or TNTech and so on, the utilities in particular, the central bank, bringing their matters through the Essential Services Division, because those employers or those utilities and those organizations are considered essential public organizations and that they provide essential public services. Yeah?
Right. Excellent. I know you'd have mentioned earlier on that only workers who are members of trade unions can seek redress at the Industrial Court. So I want us to talk a bit about trade unions. If you could give us a definition of what constitutes a trade union and how does one become recognized?
Okay, so a trade union is essentially a body of persons who come together and for the purpose of collective bargaining, and they are required to register under what we call the Trade Union Act. The Trade Union Act specifies that any 7 persons with an interest in the working class and industrial relations can come together, fill out an application as members of this trade union and seek to be registered as a trade union. Now, there's a distinction between registration as a trade union and recognition of a trade union. As I said, the Trade Union Act. You register, there is the application and so on that you fill out, and you basically register as a trade union with the Ministry of Labor. Recognition is a different process. So after you have registered as a trade union, it is only then you can become recognized. By recognition, we mean that you become recognized by the court for the purpose of collective bargaining for a particular group of employees in a workplace, right? This requires the trade union now that has been registered under the Trade Union Act to gather a majority of members from the particular workspace that it wants to represent before the industrial court. And so it would go into a mode, these seven people who would have formed the trade union would now start what we call organizing. They would get into the workplace through contact directly or indirectly, email, phone, or even direct contact with workers in the workplace and seek their request to join the trade union. And this the worker would do by paying financial dues and registering as a member of the trade union. When the trade union that has been registered has a majority of the workers in a particular workspace, it would formally request from what we call a recognition and certification board, which is an arm of the industrial court, to become recognized as a majority trade union for the particular group of workers. And after a process has been gone through, it will get what is called a recognition certificate that recognizes or gives the union the authority to bargain collectively with the employer for that particular group of workers. That recognition certificate remains in perpetuity unless recalled by the recognition and certification board.
Right. Now, how does that tie into the concept of a bargaining unit? Is it that these people who become the recognized majority union, are they automatically a bargaining unit?
All right. So we spoke just now about getting the recognition. So once the trade union has gathered the majority support, so to speak, in a workplace, it has 50% plus one at least other worker. It is now what we might call in control of the workspace for collective bargaining purposes. And so it would form, when it goes for recognition at the recognition board, it would say that this amount of people, this 50% and more persons that we represent, we want to collectively bargain for them. And that group of persons is what is known as the bargaining unit, right? Now, in a workplace, you may have more than one bargaining unit. You may have one, two, or three, or four bargaining units. But the union gets recognition to represent only particular bargaining units. That is, those units for which it has recognition or which it basically controls 50% or more membership in that particular workspace. So that, let's say you have an organization, there are 100 persons, 50 workers and 5 managers and 10 directors. The 50 workers would be a separate bargaining unit from the managers, who would be in another bargaining unit, and the directors would be in a bargaining unit. So the workplace is classified now into bargaining units. You have 3 separate bargaining units. But the union is only recognized to collectively bargain for one of those units. Get me? Yeah.
Great. What would you say are the benefits of being unionized for workers?
Okay. The benefits for being unionized for workers are numerous, in the sense that not only is the union involved in bargaining and negotiating with an employer for better terms and conditions, such as wages and salaries, improvements in working conditions, such as the provision of uniforms by the employer and so on, holidays, leave, paternity leave, maternity leave, those kinds of things. But the union also functions and has a national political role, if I may say so, in the sense that it can influence legislation for the national good. And we know right now, for example, that there is the idea of changing the retirement age from 60 to 65, right? The trade union movement would be an integral component of the national landscape in fashioning whether we change the retirement age from 60 to 62 or 65, as the case might be, dependent. So in that sense, the benefit of joining a union is for its members or the workers to have their voices heard, not only in the singular workspace, but also on the national landscape, and to, let's say, influence the terms and conditions under which workers generally, whether they're in the unionized environment or not, to benefit from whatever happens to workers throughout Trinidad and Tobago.
Excellent, Anderson. This is a good place to take a break. So at this point in time, we'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. Welcome back and thank you for remaining with us. And listen, before the break, you were giving us some of the benefits as it relates to becoming unionized. At this point, I want us to drill down a bit deeper into the whole concept of disputes. And I want you to talk a bit about the situations that, from your experience, give rise to industrial relations disputes.
Okay, thanks, Colin, for having me again. Industrial relations disputes. Well, there are a myriad of situations that could give rise to industrial relations disputes. So, for example, a simple thing like a dismissal of a worker or the non-promotion of a worker. Those are what are called trade disputes. There would be a grievance procedure to follow by the worker to get the matter to the industrial court. But there are also other disputes that are covered by a general term used in the Industrial Relations Act, where the employer fails to meet and treat and enter into negotiations and collective bargaining with the union. Now, that is very broad in the sense that if an employer in a unionized environment were to do anything that was to affect terms and conditions of workers, without meeting and consulting and negotiating with the trade union, it could be construed as an industrial relations offense. So, for example, an employer, if he decides to change his working hours and there's a trade union presence in that work environment, in the sense that there's a bargaining unit covered by a trade union, then the employer, before he changes his working hours, he's required to meet and treat and consult and have agreement with the union, because that is a change in the terms and conditions of workers. Or let's say the employer wants to bring in a new access system into his business place. We know the crime situation these days, how it is. If he chooses to bring in a new access system into his place, he must, or is required by law, to meet and treat and consult with the union before he does that. Again, that's a change in terms and conditions for the workers. And if he does it without consultation of the union, again, it could be construed as of an industrial relation offense. So that the concept of industrial relations offense are far-reaching, they are wide, they are broad, you know. And the essential thing to avoid what are called industrial relations offenses is that where a union is recognized or has a majority presence, it is incumbent upon the employer to meet and treat and negotiate and collectively bargain with the trade union before implementing any change in terms or conditions of the workers. Not only that, if the employer were to act outside, for example, the order, an order of the court handed down after a dispute has reached the industrial court, it has basically breached a court order. And again, that would be an industrial relations offense. Or if the employer doesn't follow the terms and conditions set down in the collective agreement, where there is a collective agreement, those instances would also be construed as industrial relations offenses.
Now, we all know about the Ministry of Labor. From time to time, we see they have different advertisements on television and social media and so on, trying to sensitize persons as to their rights. But what would you say is the role of the Minister of Labor in dealing with industrial relations disputes?
Okay, so to put it like this way, the Industrial Relations Act set out specific functions of the Minister of Labor and the Ministry of Labor. There's a symbiotic relationship between the Industrial Court and the Ministry of Labor, insofar as there's a process set out in the Industrial Relations Act that takes the worker from where he raises his grievance at the workplace. And the first step after the grievance at the workplace isn't solved is for the trade union to refer the matter to the Minister of Labor for what is called conciliation. There's a conciliation unit at the Ministry of Labor that is responsible for entertaining trade disputes at the conciliation stage. And it is the first step in solving.
Just clarify what you mean by conciliation.
Okay, conciliation is the process whereby the parties that dispute, the employer and the trade union on behalf of a worker, can go to the ministry or are required to go to the ministry to have their matter solved amicably with the presence of what we call conciliation officers from the ministry who would guide the process of settling the matter without it reaching to the industrial court, and where the process at the industrial court is really to litigate the matter. So that the conciliation is the first step. The law, in other words, gives the parties, the employer and the trade union on behalf of the worker, a chance to settle the matter amicably with the guidance of, let's say, the Minister of Labor, who is a recognized person, but he does it through his conciliation officers and the conciliation unit. So conciliation is a step for solving the matter without recourse to the formalities involved in court litigation. Okay. Apart from that, the Minister of Labor, the Ministry of Labor, is involved in a host of other matters or issues and terms and conditions set out in legislation that affect workers. So, for example, the Ministry of Labor is responsible for administering the OSHA Act, right? It is responsible for administering the Minimum Wages Act and the Maternity Protection Act, which are all pieces of legislation that affects workers' rights. And ultimately, if there's a breach there and matters are not solved, all matters under those acts would ultimately reach the industrial court. So that is the function of the Minister of Labor. He's a buffer between the worker and the employer for which or on whom they can bounce off their problems and situations and try to solve it at conciliation without reaching the industrial court.
Right. Would you say that conciliation is generally effective or ineffective?
Okay. So even if conciliation fails at the Ministry of Labor, right, the parties to a dispute can still be ordered by the industrial court to enter into conciliation, or they can request conciliation even before they start litigation at the industrial court. Conciliation, in my mind, is very, very effective in the sense that my statistics may be a bit off, but at least half of the matters that are eventually, or half of the matters that can be considered disputes, are solved before they reach a hearing at the industrial court. So conciliation is a very effective tool, both at the Ministry of Labor and prior to going to full-fledged hearing at the industrial court.
Now, there's a natural conflict between the interests of the employer and the employee, where at times the employer would be highly focused on profit, whereas the employee now would be focused on the job that they are required to do and getting adequate compensation and having the right tools and equipment to do their job in a safe and a proper environment. So in that situation where you have sometimes diametrically opposing interests, how would you say that the industrial relations climate can be improved?
Okay, so the thing about it is that, as you say, management and labor are diametrically opposed. The employer has a profit motive or what we call getting the biggest bang for his buck, whereas the worker is more interested in getting the best pay or the best compensation for the labor that he puts out once you are classified as a worker. How then do we bridge that gap or bring together those opposites? Well, education and training is one of the most important ways I think that our society in Trinidad and Tobago can bring together management and workers to work closer and in a more harmonious way. Right? In the sense that the employer can actually get more contributions from a worker and more support from a worker if, for example, they were to meet halfway on most issues. Right? And as I say, this would include more training and more education on both parties' part. One thing I have come to realize over the years in Trinidad and Tobago, our human resource practitioners who are employed this is my own personal view, not the view of any organization. Human resource practitioners in Trinidad and Tobago are generally trained with North American and European systems, or they are trained using those systems to manage workers. And one of the biggest drawbacks, I think, is that they do not understand our industrial relations climate and the fact that we have an Industrial Relations Act that gives so much or can be used so much to basically smooth things over both between the employer and the worker and basically provides a more harmonious relationship in the work environment. So I think every HR practitioner should get familiar with our industrial relations climate, which is different and unique when compared to North America or Europe. That's the first thing. The other thing is that there needs to be more bipartisan relationships between the employer and the trade union movement, and by extension, the workers, right? So rather than, and as we say, most of the industrial relations disputes and offenses arise because the employer, although he might be obligated to consult with the union, he doesn't do that. He goes about, let's say, imposing terms and conditions without that spirit of negotiation and consultation. So that bipartisan approach to solving issues in the workplace, I think, could go a long way in assisting with the industrial relations climate. And the third thing is that when there are going to be major changes in working conditions on a national scale, I think there need to be what is called tripartite consultation and negotiation between the state or government, as the case might be, labor and employer. And the thing about it is that the Industrial Relations Act focuses heavily on conciliation, which is basically having parties solve their own issues through dialogue and discussion. And to me, that is a way for us to solve a lot of our industrial relations problems in Trinidad and Tobago. Dialogue between management and worker, between the trade union movement and the employer class, between the government, the trade union, and the employer.
And before we go, I want us to talk a bit about productivity. Because, you know, there's a common saying that in this country, sometimes there's a poor work ethic, or sometimes there may be high absenteeism in certain workplaces and all those different things like that. So I want you to give us a brief reflection on the whole aspect of productivity from your standpoint as someone who's involved in the trade union movement.
Okay, so the thing about it is that there must be productivity. Productivity is not so much an issue for the trade union movement. The mere fact that, let's say, a banking institution could declare $1.something billion in profit for the last financial year has to be that somebody is producing to ensure that that type of profit is gained by an institution or by an employer. And it's not one, the whole banking sector, for example, they declare loads and loads of profits. If there was no productivity, could there have been that amount of profits coming out of an organization? I would say no. So this issue about non-productivity and high rates of absenteeism, particularly from the private sector, is a no-no as far as I am concerned. Because all private sector organizers stay in business because they can make profits. If they're not making profits, they will close down. If there is no productivity, there cannot be profits. Right? With respect to the state sector, the thing about the state sector, if people recall, we just came out of a COVID situation. Did this country, Trinidad and Tobago, grind to a halt? No. Banks were able to make billions of dollars of profits, but people were home. whose salaries were the banks taking out their mortgages and so on from, while all these public officers or the state sector was at home. So to me, to say that there's no productivity is a kind of myopic view coming from a one-sided class of people who would basically see in billions of dollars of profit. But again, that opposition between worker and employer is most prevalent than that, in the sense that the business class, for example, they are getting their things done because every business has to go through a bureaucratic process with the state. And it is state workers that would be. It is state sectors. It is state workers that basically run this process through which businesses or the private sector go through to make their profits, because businesses don't exist in a vacuum. There are rules and regulations that they are required to run by. And it is the state sector that does this, you know. So to the extent that we have one of the highest GDP, we will have one of the highest per capita income. Our country has not ground to a halt. I mean, the Minister of Finance boasted recently that we would have raised over $4 billion US in revenues from the oil and natural gas sector, so to speak. The only way you could extract oil from the ground is if you have workers. And to boast about these enormous set of income and profits means that there is productivity. It's only productivity could create these enormous profits and these enormous largesse that the state now enjoys.
That's good, Anderson. You make a lot of sense. I'm afraid we have to leave it there for today's episode, but I would just like to sincerely thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. This really was a great conversation, and I wish you all of the very best in your endeavors.
Thank you, Colin, and anytime, thanks again.
Excellent. You are welcome. Now, folks, this has brought us to the end of another episode of the Legal Corner podcast series. I'd like to remind you to check us out on social media. On Facebook, we are the Legal Corner podcast series. Instagram, we are at the Legal Corner podcast. We are also on the Patreon platform if you are interested in supporting our work financially. If you enjoyed this show, I'd like to ask you to share it with your friends and family. Feel free to leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. We'd also love it if you subscribe to the podcast so you won't miss any of our future episodes. Special thanks to the members of our promotional team who are helping us get our message out. Bye for now, and God bless.
Thank you for listening to the Legal Corner podcast series. For more information, please visit us at our Facebook or Instagram pages, or send your comments to thelegalcornerpodcast@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.